This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Is there a more thankless job in the world than being a substitute teacher? All right, you're right, there probably are. But think about this. Walking into a room with 20 to 30 middle school kids looking to make the next 50 minutes of your life miserable doesn't exactly sound like a party.
It's a very sort of a bizarre situation because you're a temp. You're a person who's there filling in for somebody else.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll talk to someone who became a substitute teacher and wrote a book about it. We'll also hear about a Native American woman's experiences in boarding school, head to Spain, and visit a school for bullfighters. And we'll spend an academic minute hearing about what all the cool kids are probably not really doing. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Back in 2014, after a brief orientation course and some fingerprinting sessions, renowned writer Nicholson Baker became an on-call substitute teacher in a Maine public school district. A dispatcher woke him up at 5:40 every morning and sent him off to one of several nearby schools. When he got there, he did his best to follow lesson plans and help his students get something done. Substitute teachers hold a unique position in the educational community. Baker writes about the experience in his new book called Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids. He spoke about the experience with The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue, who asked why he took up this project.
Well, partly it's just curiosity. I want to know what goes on in classes. I mean, everyone's been a student in school at some point, but life has changed, and I watched both my kids go through Maine public schools. And I sort of had a shadowy sense of what they were doing, but what is it actually like to be in class? What does it feel like? I'd forgotten that. I couldn't reconstruct that from my own memories. And I'd been myself through an alternative public high school in Rochester, New York, called the School Without Walls. So I had a sort of unusual background. But the schools that I was looking at in Maine were very traditional. So what is a traditional high school like? I had a sort of nostalgic wanting to find out what that felt like. So I signed up as a substitute just to find out what the reality of American education was like.
Was it always in the back of your mind that you wanted to write about it?
Yeah, definitely. And I said in my job application as a substitute that being a substitute seems like the fastest, most efficient way of finding out what the inner life of a classroom. It is, even though it's a sort of a bizarre situation because you're a temp. You're a person who's there filling in for somebody else, and that somebody else is a professional, trained, seasoned teacher. I'm somebody who is a complete ignoramus, and essentially a person who doesn't know anything about what's going on in the class, doesn't know people's names, doesn't know the subject matter. That's kind of an interesting perspective because you have to make it work, make it be real, avoid too many catastrophes right from the beginning. It's really hard. It's really hard to be that vulnerable and that kind of exposed in a way in front of kids who, in some cases, want to make your life miserable.
And how much of that did you see of the stereotypical how kids treat a substitute teacher?
Well, you know, the movie versions of how classes work are really, they're fine. They are just totally out of date. They're unnuanced. They, you know, I think if you... real teachers know this. It's that a class is a world. It's a universe. It's a gigantic, complicated series of cross currents and forces that are really incalculably complex. I know it sounds grandiose to say that, but all of these are individual human beings with their own histories and desires and rivalries and old grudges and new enthusiasms and senses of humor. And you never know what's going to happen next. So it's a completely unpredictable universe. It's really exciting. And I haven't seen other... The reason I wrote the book, essentially, is the TV and book accounts of how classrooms operate seemed to me inadequate. Mm-hmm. The substitute teaching that I did and that I recorded in this book is an attempt to fill something, a gap that's missing, is a feeling of how what it feels like to live through, day by day, live through classes with kids. And I want people to be immersed in this reality and listen to what children are saying, because they're really interesting. They're lovable, they're funny, they're infuriating, they're crazy making. They are interesting, and I think you don't know how education works until you actually listen to the way they talk and think about what they're doing.
If you walked into a graduate level or even a college literature course, people would say, "Oh my God, it's Nicholson Baker." They would many would know who you are. I assume you didn't run into that with these kids.
Well, first of all, that's very kind of you to say, but no, I think I walked into a college literature course. I mean, maybe a few people would say.
Yeah, well,
but
I think so.
Yes, and I've taught some, I've filled in with college classes. Teaching college is so easy compared to being a substitute teacher. The challenges are just huge, because college kids are fundamentally fairly respectful. I mean, they may surf and text and stuff in class, but they're not going to just talk outright throughout the entire seminar.
Weren't interested in your background. None of the kids were saying, "Oh, that's Mr. Baker, and he wrote a book about phone sex once."
No, and I absolutely am very glad that they were not going to say that, because I've written a book. I've written a book about World War II. Sometimes they would say, "What do you do? Are you a hippie?
Yeah.
Or are you a?" they said, "Are you a? Are you a professor?" You know, and I would say, "Well, I write books for a living." "Oh, what kind of books do you write?" And I would say, "Well," I would definitely stress the nonfiction books.
Sure.
Because I didn't want to get into anything that would be off color or risque, obviously. Life has a lot of different, levels, and school is, I don't know. Nobody cared, honestly. They needed substitute teachers, and I was game and willing to do it, and the students were delighted by me in the sense that I was an odd-looking person with a white beard, and they would come into the class, and they'd do this wonderful double take of, "Oh, we have a sub today?" And it was just a kind of thrilled, malevolent feeling sometimes of, we're gonna have a wild time today, we did.
I mean, this is a 700-page book, and some of the most startling and really poignant moments of the book are when you talk about these kids. You deal a lot with concern, and one of the surprises you had was the mental health of these kids, of just how many kids are medicated and are struggling with mental and behavioral conditions.
Well, I mean, look, the pile a lot of work on kids. There's a lot of homework and there's a lot of regimented things and learning targets and stuff they have to do. So kids get anxious and parents then worry. These are not prosperous parents. These are mostly poor parents, and they take their kid to a doctor, and the doctor prescribes some fancy pill, and that is not necessarily a good thing at all. And I saw kids who were ridiculously over-medicated, and it just made their life that much worse. Mm. So that's one of the things that over-education, the tightening up of rigor, and the making school harder, making the day harder for kids, happens with a real cost. I mean, people are suffering. Kids are being made miserable. So one of the things that I wanted to show was the complexity of suffering, the kinds of sub-varieties of misery that these busy days can create for children. And over-medication is one of the consequences of that.
Again, the name of Nicholson Baker's new book is Substitute, Going to School with 1,000 Kids. He spoke with the Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue. As a child on Montana's Crow Reservation, Peggy White Well-Known Buffalo was taken from her home, put on a bus, the first bus she ever saw, and sent to a Bureau of Indian Affairs boarding school out of state. While there, she was punished for speaking her language and for following traditional Crow spiritual practices. The experience, as it was for most Native American children, was a traumatic one. As an adult, Peggy has dedicated her life to helping Crow children connect with their history, their culture, their language, and their place. From the program Mountain West Voices, Clay Scott has the story.
I was driving through the Crow Reservation in southeastern Montana on a cold, gray day with a hard rain that wouldn't let up, and I noticed an unusual-looking cluster of buildings surrounded by cottonwood trees. I parked by a locked gate where a hand-painted sign read, "Well-Known Buffalo Center, Empowering Youth to Promote a Just Future." A spindly-legged foal took shelter on the porch of a house, and a couple of dogs watched me. It was raining too hard to get out of the car, but I was too curious to leave. After a few minutes, a woman emerged from the house without a raincoat. She didn't seem at all surprised to see me, and we went inside to talk.
My name is Peggy White, Well-Known Buffalo. That's my white English name. My Indian name is Bala Sashilish, meaning one who has abundance. I live here in Garryowen, Montana, and I live at the foothills of where the Battle of the Little Bighorn took place. This is my family's allotted land. Where I built my home is where the Sioux and Cheyenne children hid and mothers hid while the Battle of the Little Bighorn was going on. I was raised on a reservation. I believe in the Crow way. My life is the Crow way. I was sent to an Indian boarding school in South Dakota called Peer Indian School. And it was in the 60s. I was very young. And my mother had eight kids. And through the eight kids, my mother had to select half of them to go to a boarding school, and she could keep the other half. She had to give my father's allotted land to the state of Montana to support the other four. So my mother chose me. And when I got there, I was also scared, and I was also told not to speak Crow, my Crow language, Apsalugo language, and there was a lot of Crow kids that were taken, and a bus came and picked us up, and I never rode in a bus before. I had to work, clean things. They started me as cleaning. I was younger, so they had me go to the little girls and little boys' dorm, which were young kids, babies, and toddlers, to go and clean them up. But I always went, I held them, and they would just hold on to me. And some of them were very thin. But I held them, and I'd pray and I'd sing to them. But, you know, I was singing my lullaby songs in Crow, and no one got mad at me. I went there just to speak my language to these kids that, because I couldn't do it anywhere else. So I'll talk to them in Crow, and I'll sing lullabies and hold them, carry them, clean them. And every time I work on a child, it's what you call a massage in your Western ways. But in a traditional Crow way, we call it Bapajila, Bagadhoase. The one who treats children, the one who takes care of children. And that's what I do. Oh, 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 oh. Owa, ahowa, ishbobo bushi gadag, ahowa, aho, aho, ahowa.
You've been listening to Peggy White, Well-Known Buffalo. Mountain West Voices is produced in association with the O'Connor Center for the Rocky Mountain West, a regional studies and public education program of the University of Montana.
Additional support was provided by the Greater Montana Foundation. To listen to and download more stories from around the Rocky Mountain West, go to mountainwestnews.org. I'm Clay Scott.
Still to come, as bullfighting becomes less popular around the world, there are still dozens of schools teaching the profession across Spain. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. Or go to the podcast page and subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Despite long campaigns from animal rights activists, which have greatly reduced the number of bullfighting events, the tradition is still popular in many parts of Spain. Young people continue to train at the 52 bullfighting schools across the country. From DW Radio, Haha Yapsi reports.
No,
it's a warm spring Monday morning in Albacete. Sebastián Cortés, who heads the bullfighting school here, has taken 12 of his students outside for a practical class. One by one, they get to practice their skills on a calf.
Te lleva la muleta y te sorprende.
17-year-old Jesús seems to be having a hard time. The headmaster is far from satisfied with his performance today, but the criticism from his teacher doesn't discourage him, because there's nothing in the world that Jesús wants more than to become a bullfighter.
Desde pequeño, siempre me han gustado.
I've been into bullfighting since I was a little kid. My parents always took me to bullfights at the fair here in Albacete.
Mucho a la feria de Albacete, sobre todo.
Like Jesús, José's fascination also started from an early age.
To me, bullfighting is the most beautiful profession in the world. It's art. It is everything.
To realize their dreams, the 43 students must train 6 hours per week at the bullfighting school. The majority of the students, however, dedicate way more time to their passion. Training is essential if they are to go on to become professional bullfighters, especially given the limited number of jobs nowadays. Speaking to the headmaster in his office, Sebastián Cortés explains that the public's attitude towards bullfighting in Spain has completely changed in the last 30 years.
De la época mía a la de ahora ha cambiado todo.
In my time, everyone in Spain would go and see a bullfight. They would look forward to it. Nobody would criticize it. And the uproar we see now did not exist.
Cortés admits he worries about his students' future.
If local governments continue to cut subsidies for bullfighting like they do now, it's bad news for all the students in bullfighting schools across Spain. There are less and less bullfights. That means that young bullfighters have few opportunities to practice and prove themselves.
And proving oneself is essential, since aspiring bullfighters need to find sponsors willing to financially support their careers. It's José's turn now to practice. As the 15-year-old steps into the arena, his classmates, who sit on the balcony above, cheer him on. And while the students are seemingly supportive of one another, they admit that there's still a lot of competition between them.
We all have the chance to become a bullfighter, but it's becoming more and more difficult. Some of us will be able to realize our dream, others not.
There That is why, according to student Elena, one of the only two girls in the school, it is important to distinguish oneself as a bullfighter.
I have a certain advantage. The fact that I am a woman makes me already different from the many men in this profession.
The students hope that as Spain's economy recovers, opportunities for the country's bullfighters will also improve. But the majority admits they have a backup plan, in case they will not be able to realize their dreams as bullfighters. Jesús is one of them.
I will never stop improving myself as a bullfighter, but when I finish high school, I will also study economics at university.
After a week of classes, the 43 students are training at the arena of Albacete. Professional bullfighter Emilio Huertas is instructing them today.
In my school were 800 students and only 11 of us have actually became bullfighters.
En mi época solamente hay 11 de 180.
Emilio doubts many of the students in today's class have successful bullfighting careers ahead of them.
The majority of them will not be able to realize their dream.
Hager Jobse, DW.
You know all that edgy stuff you think the cool kids are doing? They're probably really not doing it at all. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
All the cool kids are doing it. Or are they? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Mitch Prinstein, professor and director of clinical psychology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, explores whether perception is reality.
What do you think is the number one predictor of adolescent drug use? Delinquency? Even unsafe sex? The answer is how much adolescents perceive that their peers are engaging in these exact same behaviors. But that's kind of a trick answer. Notice I didn't say it's how much adolescents' peers are actually engaging in these behaviors. No, it's based on what teens perceive that their peers are doing. And this is key, because just like adults, teenagers tend to stink at estimating the behavior of others. Our perceptions can be very distorted, and usually we don't even realize it. My colleagues and I decided to do a study to examine just how much adolescents might be misperceiving their peers' actions. Spoiler alert, if you were cool in high school, you might not like these results very much. We started by asking adolescents in a typical public high school to tell us about the different groups in their school. If you've ever seen The Breakfast Club, you know exactly what I mean. We found out which kids were the jocks, the populars, the brains, and the burnouts. Then we asked all these kids to tell us how much they really did engage in a wide variety of risk behaviors. When we asked teenagers how much they thought the jocks and populars drank alcohol, smoked pot, or had sex, their estimations were sky high. But it was all a misperception. Jocks actually had no more sex than the brains, and their substance use wasn't that much different either. Why does this matter? Because when we followed these kids over the next 2 years, we learned that the more teens thought that the populars used substances, the more likely they were to increase their own drug use over time. We can all remember what the jocks and populars were like in high school, but maybe we didn't know them that well after all.
That was Mitch Prinstein of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.